Tonight we are going to take a look at Job chapter 3. And last week we began our study of the book of Job, and it really was a fast, action-packed beginning, wasn't it? Although it wasn't the kind of action you'd like to see, we saw two different scenes, one in heaven and one on the earth. It was kind of a shift of play sites back and forth, which really is the way of real life, if you consider the spiritual realm versus our existence physically here on earth. The life and times of Job is sort of a test case for us. Satan has challenged God. That was right up in the beginning of the book there. And he said to God, "Have you put a hedge around Job and have given him everything? But if those things are taken away from him, he will curse you to your face." It really was sort of a slander of mankind and a blasphemy towards God. Why would a God, a loving, holy, righteous, all-powerful God, not just snuff out Satan? Have you ever heard that? Or maybe even asked yourself that question? We talked about this in the prison ministry last night. The guy said, "Well, why did God even allow evil?" There are a lot of things that you could say why to in this book, or even life itself. Why would God, being so loving, allow this deep, horrific thing to happen to Job? One of the reasons is that if he wouldn't have given us choices, we could make a case before him that we never had unconditional love offered to us. We'd never be able to choose to love him. And he knew what real true love was. So that's one of the things. But there's a lot of whys, and a lot of it we don't have answers to. This chapter 3 that we're going to look at tonight, well, what it takes our understanding of the state of mind that Job is in now and show us really a bare soul. A bare soul, one that maybe you can relate to, or maybe at one time in your life in the past, or possibly in the future, you will be able to. The book of Job presents the problem. It states the stripping of a man's soul. He's had everything in life taken away from him. It does not give the solution, although answers are suggested. You must go to the New Testament to find the real true answers to the book of Job. And really, that's sort of true for the entire Old Testament. The answers lie in the New Testament. What it does is prepare us for Jesus Christ's coming. You need to keep this in mind as we work through this book. It can be depressing if you don't keep your mind settled on Jesus Christ. He is at the center. We are blessed. Here we are, studying the book of Job of the Old Testament, one of the oldest books written in time. And we have the perspective of Jesus Christ in the center of our life. So what a difference it would make, rather someone in the Old Testament days looking at it. So let's get into this. This is a great story, beginning in verse 1. After this, and remember, after this is after all the calamity, Job is sitting in an ash pile, taking a broken piece of pottery, scraping his boils away. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. You know, it was 7 days of silent suffering. Job spoke not to curse God, mind you, but to curse the day of his birth. Why was I ever born? Those are the words of a hurting soul. The friends sat and they waited silently until Job spoke. And that is an important lesson for us that come alongside of people that are hurting, that are really going through it. I have been there. I have experienced it. I have been at the bedside as I've watched close friends take their last breaths. He'd gotten to a place that he cursed the day he was born. When we curse a blessing, we are in trouble. And truly, birth is a blessing. Conception is a blessing that comes from God. We know that from Genesis 30, 1 and 2 verses there, and Psalms 139. So when we curse a blessing, we are questioning the goodness of God. The miracle of conception. Think about that. It takes place in the darkness of a woman's womb between a man and a woman, where only God creates life out of two sets of genes, out of all the millions of possibilities. It's amazing if you really think about it, if you know the science of the biology of what really happens when a man and a woman comes together, the possibilities are unbelievable. But yet, Psalms 139 tells us that God is right there knowing each cell, each egg, each sperm, as they come together. It isn't by chance. It's amazing to me. Job is in a place that there are others have been also. We think of Jeremiah. In chapter 20, verse 14, he was so discouraged with life that he too cursed the day he was born. What it really boils down to is depression. Depression because of what he has gone through and what he is going through. It can completely be life paralyzing. It can threaten you to the point of contemplating suicide. But before we go there, let's see what keeps a person from going there. Blessings. We need to counter blessings, as the old song says. We need to counter blessings sometimes one by one. And it's those blessings that will keep us from getting into that deep, dark hole. When we are really sick, and we all know this, we've been there. Every one of us have had the flus, or we've had a cold where we thought, oh man, I'm like walking death. I've said that many times. It may not be true, but we feel it. We feel so sick. And when you are sick, you have a hard time with reality. You start questioning the goodness of God because you feel so lousy. And so this is where Job is. He's sick. He's lost. He has a hard time putting it all into perspective. And Job spoke in verse 2 and said, "May the day perish in which I was born, and the night in which it was said, a male child is conceived." Notice here that it is not a fetus. He didn't say anything about a fetus or an it. This is another scripture that you can go to point out to those that argue with you. Life begins at conception. May that day be darkness, verse 4. May God above not seek it, nor the light shine upon it. May darkness and the shadow of death claim it. May a cloud settle on it. May the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, may darkness seize it. May it not rejoice among the days of the year. May it not come into the number of the months. You know, in Genesis 1, verse 3, we see God saying, "Let there be light." But here, Job, he wants to reverse it. He says, "Let there be darkness." He is so despondent, so depressed, so down that he can't see anything good around him. All this is ridiculous. that is the way we are when we are in a place of darkness. We don't make sense. We don't rationalize properly. But this is poetry too. We've already mentioned that. Job meant to give a full vent to his feelings. And so it was wrote poetically. He wished that day could be so annihilated that even God would forget it, that day that he was born. Job wanted the day lost in total darkness, not even numbered anymore as a day on the calendar. It's taken us all as readers to a place to understand the depth of darkness that Job is experiencing. Verse 7, "Oh, may that night be barren. May no joyful shout come into it. May those cursed who curse the day, those who are ready to arouse Leviathan, may the stars of its morning be dark. May it look for light but have none, and not see the dawning of the day, because it did not shut up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide sorrow from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth? Why did I not perish when I came from the womb? Why did the knees receive me? Or why the breasts that I should nurse?" He closed his curse with four whys. Questions that nobody but God could answer. It's easy to ask why, but difficult to get the right answer. There's nothing wrong with asking why either. I don't want you to misunderstand, as long as we don't get the idea that God owes us an answer. He does not. Even our Lord asked why. Jesus Christ, "Why hast thou forsaken me?" Remember that? But if the Lord did tell us why things happen as they do, would that really ease our pain or heal our broken hearts? Would we be able to understand the situation better if we knew why? I doubt it. We live on promises, don't we? If he gave me the answers to everything, I'm not sure I could handle it. But I live so much better on a promise, knowing who's behind that promise. So we shouldn't spend too much time, I believe, asking God why. "For now," verse 13, "I have lain still and been quiet. I would have been asleep, then I would have been at rest." Some think that this verse right here, verse 13, that's talking about just going to sleep, being still, being quiet, refers to soul sleep after death. Now, I know that some of you, I've talked to some of you in the church here, you asked me about life after death, and we hold, I certainly hold a view of what this text, I believe, says. And there are some that believe that you just go to sleep for a time until the day that God raises you. The people that believe that way build a doctrine here out of this saying that when you die, we just go to sleep until God is able to take us up to heaven. But this is not the case here. This is not the verse to build anything on. Remember, Job is speaking out of depression. And we can never build a principle out of that. Doctrine comes by the Spirit in Revelation. The New Testament says in 2 Corinthians 5:8, "We are confident, yes, well pleased rather, to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord." Jesus also said to the thief on the cross that he'd be in paradise with him that day. Luke 23:43. Everything that I know of in the Bible that teaches about life after death, we are either in paradise or we are in the presence of the Lord And so I believe that when you leave this earth, when you stop taking air into your lungs and your brain ceases to function, you will be in the presence of Jesus Christ. And what a wonderful promise that is to carry on. With kings and counselors of the earth, verse 14, who built ruins for themselves, or with princes with who had gold, who filled their houses with silver, or why was I not hidden like a stillborn child, like infants who never saw light? There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. You know, death often sounds like a better alternative to a depressed person or someone that's going through sickness, cancer, some of those long-term illnesses, rather than struggling and trying to get through it. It is a delusion, though. It is a delusion that Satan brings to offer a temptation toward suicide. I see it all the time in prisons. I see it in the hospitals as I go to visit folks that have some of these cancerous things. After death, there is judgment. I try to remind. You know, it's not like you just go into sleep and you slip away from your problems. You enter into eternity. You enter into God's presence, or you enter into eternal damnation, which really is not... I mean, look at the story of Lazarus and the rich man. If you're not prepared to go to the right place, why would you want death? And many times people that are struggling with depression and commit suicide are considering those types of things that aren't saved. They lose hope of life as they know it. There the prisoners rest together. Verse 18, they did not hear the voice of the oppressor. The small and great are there, and the servant is free from his master. If you wanted to look up that story that I mentioned about Lazarus and the rich man, that's in Luke 16:17. This illustration that death somehow relieves one's burden is only true for those going through a difficult time. After death, there we really enter into a whole new realm, the spiritual realm. It is true that everybody is on the same level at that time, only it may be different residences. There are those that go to heaven and those that go into hell. I believe that when a non-believer passes on, that he immediately goes to a holding place until the day of judgment. We see that with that story of Lazarus and the rich man. He was in torment, a place of torment. That's really an ugly picture if you think about it. And it ought to spur us on as Christians to share the good news of Jesus Christ so much more with fervency. Verse 20 there, who long for death, but it does not come, and search for it more than hidden treasures, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they can find the grave. I talked to a person in prison that has contemplated suicide fairly recent, and I've counseled people in our church that don't want to go on living, going through some difficult times, but that's not the same as suicide. There are people that, and hear me out here, there are people that think about dying, think about how great it would be to escape the problems, and I'm so frustrated with life, I just want to die. That's not the same as suicide. Suicide is a very cold, calculated plan to end your life. And usually it's that person that is making this plan that they either succeed or they get caught up in having tried. Job never considered suicide. Never once. did he consider suicide. What he did is said that I wish that I wasn't alive. That's not the same. He was suffering. He was suffering tremendously, and I don't want to discount that. But I do not believe that he ever attempted to take his life. In 22, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they can find the grave. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? Job was misunderstanding what was going on in his life, and he thought that God had put this on him by removing his hedge of protection. It was true. God did remove it, but it was for reasons that Job didn't know. We can remove our hedge. As Christians, we can step outside of God's hedge of protection. And we can step into areas that God would not have us to go. And we can be susceptible to darkness, even demon oppression. Not possession, but oppression. We need to be careful where we go. We need to pay attention to God's leading in our lives. For my sighing comes before I eat, and my groanings pour out like water. For the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me. The worst thing that Job feared has come upon him, he says. Have you had times where you think, man, life's pretty good, things are going quite well, and you always have this little thought in the back of your head, boy, what if this happens, or what if that happens? And there's that little thought that creeps in. But we don't have to live in that dread, as Job mentions here. We have a Savior that understands our temptations, we as Christians. God says in Psalms 103:14, listen to this, for he knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. God knows what we're made of. We're made of dirt. We're made of dust. He knows we need help. And he is a God that is a creator, and he is a sustainer, and he cares for everything that goes on in our life. Verse 26, I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, for trouble comes. You know, this chapter's not a chapter that we would turn to establish anything other than seeing a great man of faith, struggle while he is under severe attack. It isn't a chapter that I'd reference to other than that. It should give us comfort if we are struggling in our faith, as we have even seen great men lose hope. God took care of Job eventually, as we were going to see. God never left him very far. He did have a hedge around him. Satan couldn't take his life, although he went down a very dark and tough road that I hope I never, or any of you in this room, or anybody ever listening to this would ever endure such trials. God prefers we speak with him honestly, though. And I think this great man Job did that very thing. He was honest, he was open, and he was transparent with his God. He had a prayer life, I do believe, that was tremendous. And when he was in that deep, dark trial, he spoke openly of his relationship with God, even though he didn't understand it correctly, and I wouldn't have either, as it went down. He was honest, and he was open, and God was very, very near to him. Let's get into chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. Then Eliphaz, the Temanite, answered and said, if one attempts a word with you, will you become weary? But who can withhold himself from speaking? You know, the first mention of the friend here. He's got three friends that sat around for a week and looked at him. Now we are introduced to the first one that speaks. This guy is the voice of experience. As he sat there for 7 days, he cannot wait any longer. He's got to speak. He starts out gently, but that'll change as we see this chapter develop in verse 3. Surely you have instructed many, and you have strengthened weak hands. Your words have upheld him who was stumbling, and you have strengthened the feeble knees. But now it comes upon you, and you are weary. It touches you, and you are troubled. Eliphaz, he says to Job that, man, you were one, the one that was, for so long, the people looked to. You were the instructor. You guided people through tough times. You did marriage counseling. You stood up there and you taught the men, this is what you do, and this comes along. And then here you are, right in the middle of a trial, and you're going to fold? That was the insinuation. People have heard you preach it for a long time. You're going to need to walk the walk, Job. I hear this all the time. I get emails almost every teaching I do. Someone will email me and ask me what I said. I had one this week. What do you mean by this? So everything I say, I must have a reason why I say it and where I found it. You know, Peter tells us to be ready to give an account for those things that you believe. And so I took that to heart literally a long time ago. And you, as a Christian, should be in the same boat. That when people ask you, why is it that you believe, then you need to be ready to give that. And that's what we are about. That's what I am instructed to do, is to be a teacher, be a shepherd in the Word, and instruct, and you guys likewise carry it on. Do you believe it, or are you some sort of fake? I don't know how a person that doesn't believe it can stand up week after week and preach it and not live up to it. I just don't know how he'd deal with his life. I don't know how he'd deal with even talking to God about it. But God, help me to be a fake this Sunday. You know, wow. You know, God, just look the other way when I get into pornography or immorality, or, you know, when I steal from the church, just look the other way. How do you do that? So this guy, he starts out in a way that is good. He's saying some right principles. And he goes on there in verse 6, is not your reverence your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Eliphaz was willing to affirm that Job was basically an upright man who only needed the wisdom to see that all deserve some punishment for sin. For no one is completely pure. Do you see how he's maneuvering the conversation? Not everybody's pure. You know, there's probably something there, Job. Remember now, verse 7, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright ever cut off? If Job is living a godly life, Eliphaz argues, then he has nothing to fear. This guy was a pretty good debater probably in high school. Because God always blesses the righteous was his point. God always blesses the righteous and judges the wicked. And I ask you, is that true? It isn't true. That's a bunch of baloney. Because for one, I mean, you can look back in early part of the Bible in Genesis, Abel was righteous. Abel presented a perfect sacrifice that God accepted, and his brother Cain killed him. So we know that the good do have things come against them. Jesus Christ was perfect in all ways, but yet he was crucified on a cross. Even as I have seen in verse 8, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. Eliphaz is using the proverb, you reap what you sow. Did Job sow everything? Did he sow something that would cause trouble? Did he? No, he didn't. He didn't have anything to do with it. This occurrence, as we saw in chapters 1 and 2, was dealt with in heaven. Job had no understanding of what took place in heaven by God and Satan. So what Eliphaz was doing here is he assumes that he did based on the circumstances. The things that were going on that were so bad and so deep and so terrible were going on because you made a mistake somewhere along the line, Job. And it's a very dangerous place for you or I to take the position of a judge. He's looking down that long nose. You can almost see his nose growing right now. And he's looking down that nose with a real critical eye, judging his brother sitting there in the ashes. He's looking down and he's saying, you know, you can move on if you'll just confess. It'll get better. But there was nothing to confess. So Job was in a tough spot. He was in a frustrated spot because he had searched his soul and asked God, where did I go wrong? By the blast of God they perish, verse 9. And by the breath of his anger they are consumed. You know, this man is wrong. God disciplines his children, yes, but he never destroys them. And yet, right there in that verse, he says, God can just blast you off the earth in a second. Well, he can do that, but he doesn't do that. He doesn't do that with his children. Eliphaz is like so many of us who give advice. We must always be careful with the words we use. What we say must be correct as best as we possibly can put it out there. And I am so aware of this as I stand in the pulpit and preach. When I say words, I'm not discouraging anybody or writing me or asking me about something I commented. I want you to do that. But I'm just saying I'm prepared to give an account for what I teach. And so you should be too. You are in the same shoes when you are sharing with a neighbor or a person at work, family, those that you come in contact with. We must be men and women of faithful truth. That's the responsibility one takes as a preacher, as a lay pastor. I challenge you to use your advice biblically. Don't just, if someone asks you about something, don't just flippantly give a word of advice, not thinking. Have you ever done that? I'd do this. And you stop after a bit and you think, that was dumb. Why did I even say that? Be careful with the words, because once they're out, they have an impact on people. The roaring of the lion, verse 10, the voice of the fierce lion, and the teeth of the young lions are broken. The old lion perishes for lack of prey, and the cubs of the lioness are scattered. Our poetry here is getting exotic. Kind of a common sense statement, though, if you look at it. If a ferocious young lion, if he breaks his teeth, he can't go to the dentist and fix them. He can't chew. So he's a goner. He's going to starve to death. Same with the old lion. When he gets too old to chase down the lamb or whatever it is that he wants to eat, well, he's going to starve. Again, he's pointing to circumstances to make his case, and now he will tell us why he has the authority to do that. Verse 12, now A word was secretly brought to me, and my ear received a whisper of it. Oh, the pride is swelling, the nose is growing. He's in a great place now, and he says, listen, Job, I have a secret. Somebody whispered in my ear. Verse 13, in disquieting thoughts from the visions of the night, when deep sleep falls on men, fear came upon me and trembling, which made all my bones shake. Ooh, it's really now getting mystical. And Paul tells us, the Apostle Paul tells us, to be very careful with people that are mystics. Let no one cheat you, Colossians 2:18, out of your reward, taking delight in false humility and worship of angels, intruding into those things which he has not seen, vainly puffed up by his fleshly mind. That is a good verse to keep in mind. There are many people that come along and they say, oh man, I had a vision, or Lord spoke to me and I just got to share this with you. And it's all a bunch of baloney. But they want to sound so very spiritual. He is about to tell a vision that I would say is not a vision at all. Because it doesn't say anywhere in this poetic carrying on, thus says the Lord, or any reverence to God. But it is really a scary mysticism. Verse 15, then a spirit passed before my face. The hair on my body stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern its appearance. A form was before my eyes. There was silence. Then I heard a voice saying, you know, this is something nobody ever knew before, because this man has had a vision. He has seen things. He has had a dream. It was a dark and probably a dark spirited dream that passed before him, if it was anything at all. Verse 17, can a mortal be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his maker? What you mean that is your great big secret, Eliphaz? Is that it? Your two proverbs here, your two principles you just laid out, can a man be mortal? To the point of more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his maker? Well, to tell you the truth, these two rhetorical questions have an obvious answer. No way. No. Man can't be greater than God. No man is pure. He's born a sinner. Now, these things are true, and he's using them in a way. He's saying, but it is not a great revelation. If it was a spoken thing from God, if it was a vision from God, it would have been revelation. But to come along and say these obvious rhetorical questions here indicates to me, at least, that this guy is all stage. He's trying to sound intelligent and be spiritual. And I think that is the problem with quite a few folks. When they're trying to help somebody, they come alongside of someone that's really struggling, really hurting, really went through some horrific stuff. And the mistake that we can make is we try to be more spiritual than we are. And it hurts. It can be disastrous. We see in the end that one of the best things that you can do when someone's hurting like that is just sit beside them. They started out 7 days doing really well. But now someone's speaking, and it begins a dialogue that'll last about 40 chapters. If he puts no trust in his servants, verse 18, if he charges his angels with error, how much more those who dwell in the houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed before a moth? We all make mistakes, he says. Even God's angels make mistakes. They choose wrong things and err. Well, we know that's true, don't we? Satan made a mistake. He chose to be equal to God. He chose to the downfall of a third of the angels in heaven. They were cast out because they made wrong choices. We do live in earthen tents of clay, and they are susceptible to collapse, as he says. Who are crushed by a moth, he says. Paul says in the New Testament in 2 Corinthians 4:7, but we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellence of the power may be of God and not of us. It is when we think it is of us that we get into trouble. We are vulnerable to collapse. And even some days a moth, as little as a moth, can come along and we could feel like we could be crushed by that. But not those that are in earthen vessels with Jesus in the center. With Jesus in the center of your life, you remain strong. Your strength will come from Him. I don't know how many people that I've talked about with depression issues that it just takes time to pray with them and set. One of the guys in my Bible study at OSP, his job, he volunteers. He could make some money and make a little savings because they do have jobs, and especially for the good guys that have been there a while, they can work their way up. But he chose to not do that, to volunteer for going up into the infirmary and sitting there beside those that have tried to commit suicide. And he sometimes, for days, will hold their hand and never speak unless they speak to him. There's something very, very important about just being there. Subtle little words of healing. They are broken in pieces, verse 20. From morning till evening, they perish forever with no one regarding. Does not their own excellence go away? They die even without wisdom. In closing this chapter here, no matter how strong or beautiful our bodies may be, they're only a brief duration that they're that way. Look at the athletes, the pro football players. They get up maybe a 10-year, 15 at best, very few of them. Most of them, do you know that the average football player has a career span of 5 years because they take such a pounding? The mighty will grow weak one day. The beautiful will grow... Well, let's see. I better be careful with what words I choose there. It's for a time. And so if you rely on your strengths in that way, you're going to be a very sad person if you rely on those things that ebb away. Eliphaz is stating truths that are wise, yes, but they are not helpful to Job. And that is what's really important for us here to take away. We need to choose helpful words. You see, it's easy to give out truth that is not pertinent, that is not geared into life's situations. We don't just need to speak any old truth, but truth that meets our need. And that I mean by this. This whole lecture that Eliphaz is giving is sort of like me The other day I saw an ant, a trail of ants in the dirt in my house. I was out working my yard over and I stepped on one of the ants. And I got right down there and I looked at him and he was trying to, you know, stretch it all out again. You know, I hadn't killed him. I just stepped on him, kind of made him have a bad day. It's kind of like me seeing that ant working and building his house and stepping on him there, and I bend over and I speak to him in his struggling state. He can't understand me. He can't get it together. I'm a giant. It's like I say to him, if you would have built your house, your little dirt house out away from where I would have been, you wouldn't have been stepped on, you dummy. It wouldn't have made any difference. It wouldn't have made any sense, you know. That's kind of what Eliphaz is doing here. He is saying all these truths that really don't apply. He's trying to be a big shot. He's trying to be an important guy. He's trying to be a revelation super Christian. And yet, what was required is humility. That is the arrogance that this man is giving out. We can be that way to, as we see lowly people, those that are struggling. I see it so much in our society these days, where those that don't have the chances, those that are handicapped, those that are have gone to prison, those that have diseases and sicknesses, those that are mentally ill, those that have lost jobs and just become depressed and give up, those are the lowly that God calls us to be ever so aware of and come alongside. And our attitude towards them really dictates whether we are able to minister to them or not. If we take the high road and look down that long nose, believe me, they will sense it. One of the first things that I learned in the prison realm is the guys can figure you out within about 10 minutes. They can figure whether you're there for real, out of the love of your heart of Jesus, or if you're there for other reasons. Humility is an attitude of the heart of a believer in Christ, always. And we must be compassionate. We must be compassionate people. And if you say to yourself tonight, oh, I'm not sure I've got that compassion there, then you pray and you ask Jesus Christ to help you with that, and He will. He's a compassionate God. And He has eyes for the lowly.